Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Malcolm Turnbull touches down in China this week in his first visit there as Prime Minister. The two-day trip, which will include Shanghai and Beijing, will juggle trade matters with political issues. Today we're joined by Hugh White, Professor of Strategic Studies at the Australian National University and a leading commentator on Chinese power in the region, to discuss the importance of this visit and the Australian-Chinese relationship more generally. Hugh White, what will and what should Malcolm Turnbull be seeking to get out of this first trip to China as PM?
Well, Michelle, what he will be seeking himself is primarily focused on the economic agenda. Turnbull is one of those who remains bullish about China. He thinks its economic prospects remain bright and he sees it as the principal source of economic opportunities for Australia over the next few years and indeed decades, and vital to his agenda for economic innovation and transformation in the Australian economy itself, which is right at the heart of his prime ministership. And he really sees China primarily through the lens of helping to drive that. But on the other hand, that agenda will be certainly supplemented by and possibly overshadowed by the darker strategic and political questions that loom over the relationship as Australia tries to juggle its very strong support for the United States and America's role in Asia with China's very clear, increasingly overt challenge to US primacy, to US power in Asia, as its economic and its strategic weight grows. And how Turnbull will manage to balance that will be for him, I think, the principal foreign policy challenge of his entire prime ministership, and it'll be very much on display over the next few days.
Do you think he's too bullish? Do you think he plays down too much the long-term dangers of China's power?
Look, I don't think he's too bullish on the economy. I think he correctly judges that although China's got very difficult economic transformation to manage and it's never going to grow at 10% per annum again the way it did back in John Howard's day, it's still got a good chance of managing the transformation well enough to sustain average growth rates over the next decade or two of 6%, say. That is a very high growth rate for an economy of that scale and will ensure that China remains a really important, no doubt the most important, economic partner for Australia over the next few decades. On the other hand, I do think he is now, as Prime Minister, downplaying the strategic challenges. He didn't do that before he became Prime Minister. In opposition, and indeed even in his earlier portfolios under the Abbott government, he gave a series of lectures and wrote a series of essays in which he commented in very sophisticated terms on the strategic implications of China's growing power, and he clearly understood and advocated the idea that we needed to see a new order emerge in Asia which accommodated China's growing power as well as maintain a strong role for the United States. But what we've seen since he became Prime Minister is he stepped back from that, and he's now, for example, in the Defence White Paper that his government produced just a couple of months ago now, putting forward an image of Asia's future which basically presupposes that America will remain the dominant power and therefore that China will be prepared to back off its challenge to US primacy and accept a position as a kind of a subordinate power indefinitely. Now, the old Malcolm Turnbull was very clear that that was just not going to happen, desirable though it might be. The new Malcolm Turnbull, as the Prime Minister, is reluctant to take those issues on. So I think he's too bullish on the strategic future, whereas I think he's probably got it about right on the economic side.
So how do we account for that transition in his thinking? Is he now seeing China really through a domestic agenda, domestic Australian agenda, and the need to play up its potential as a market for Australia?
Well, look, I think he's always seen that economic potential and how important that is to Australia domestically. But I think what's changed on the strategic side is that he does understand now, perhaps more clearly than he did before he was in the Prime Minister's office, just what a huge job of public education and acclimatisation is going to need to take place in Australia for Australians start to accept the idea that we can't just keep on relying on the United States as the dominant power in Asia to keep us safe indefinitely. Moreover, I think he's also discovered how scary it is to start trying to explain that point of view to Washington. Australian political leaders have traditionally found it very hard to go to Washington and tell Americans things they don't want to hear. This is certainly something American leaders don't want to hear. And so we saw him when he made his first trip to Washington as Prime Minister back in January, giving us, you know, making a series of comments on these issues, which could have come from, well, Tony Abbott or Julia Gillard, or for that matter, John Howard. So I think it's the pressure of actually managing the issue as Prime Minister, which has really seen him back off from his earlier, more sophisticated approach.
Of course, he'd often visited China before he became Prime Minister, as you mentioned. He gave speeches about it. He was involved in business there. How is he regarded in Beijing?
Look, I think he's well regarded in Beijing. He knows China really very well, not perhaps as well in the sort of scholarly sense as Kevin Rudd did, and Kevin Rudd is in kind of in a special category of his own, but he got to know China not through reading foreign affairs briefing papers, but by working there as a businessman himself. That means he got to see the country from the provinces up rather than just from Beijing down. He's got a bit of a sense as how the Chinese system actually works day to day to those who are actually trying to make a living within it. He's even taught himself a little bit of Mandarin. I don't think he'd stand up much competition with Kevin Rudd when it comes to the questions like how many characters do you know and how good are his tones. But I think he is probably more genuinely knowledgeable about China than any other Western leader today. And the Chinese understand that and respect it. But they don't give you a free pass for that. They still look at everything you do and evaluate it on how that works for China. And I think that's, you know, going to be one of the challenges for him.
What do you see as the main issues in the Australia-China relationship at this moment?
Well, I think they fall into three categories. The first is there's a big body of issues, of course, about the management of the economic relationship. On the good news side of that, of course, we have the FTA, and it's a question of making the FTA work best for both sides and, from Turnbull's point of view, work best for Australia. There's the challenge for both of us, certainly from an Australian side, of trying to move the economic relationship away from one which is as dependent as it has been on massive exports of iron ore and energy and so on, towards something which is more sophisticated to transform the economic relationship with China to fit Turnbull's model of transformation of the Australian economy itself. There's also a problem with steel, with China's massive overcapacity is adding to the problems which are causing the issues we have in the Australian steel industry at the moment. And then there's a second body of issues which relates to Chinese investment in Australia, which has become very sensitive. And that is something which I think Turnbull has to manage domestically here in Australia. I think he's going to find it very hard to get any help in managing that from Beijing, but that's going to be something which, if we don't get it right, is going to cause problems in the development of the economic and, for that matter, the broader relationship down the track. And then the third question, I think in many ways the hardest, is the issue of how Australia positions itself in relation to the US and China as their strategic rivalry for leadership in Asia comes to dominate Australia's strategic horizons. And that is an issue which at the moment is being played out primarily in the South China Sea. And it's tempting to try and see the South China Sea issue as, so to speak, a diplomatic and legal question. That is, how should China and the other claimant countries to those disputed rocks and reefs conduct themselves in resolving those issues? And that's the way Turnbull's trying to portray it at the moment, as a kind of a question for the lawyers to sort out and the diplomats to negotiate. But that's the wrong way to see it, because the actual disputed territories themselves are not really what the conflict in the South China Sea is all about. They're just the tokens in a much bigger game in which the stakes are literally who gets to lead Asia. The United States and China have mutually incompatible views of their future relationship. The US wants to remain the dominant power in Asia, as it's been for decades. China wants to replace it as the dominant power in Asia. It's as simple as that. They both can't succeed at that. They're too strong for one another. But they can certainly cause a great deal of disruption in the region if they keep bumping up against one another, and that's what they're doing in the South China Sea at the moment. Now, for Australia, the stakes in this are enormous. We desperately need to maintain a very strong relationship with both of those countries. And the more intense their strategic rivalry becomes, the harder it is for us to strike that balance. Now, Australian political leaders for a long time now have been saying, as a kind of a mantra, we don't have to choose between America and China. And that used to be true. That was true back in John Howard's day. but it's much less true now. And if the strategic rivalry continues to escalate, if the confrontation in the South China Sea as a sort of cutting edge of that rivalry continues to escalate over the next few months, as it very well could, then Australia is going to find it harder and harder to manage both relationships as we would wish to do. And there is indeed a significant risk, not a very high risk, but a significant risk, that a confrontation could turn into a conflict, which would be extraordinarily difficult and dangerous for the region as a whole and would put Australia in an impossible position. The United States would expect us to provide military support to the United States in a conflict with China, and I think Australian governments would find it extraordinarily hard to say yes to that, but also very traumatic to say no.
Australia has expressed concern at China's actions. Should it be doing more?
I don't think it should, because I don't think there's much more we can do. And indeed, the problem I have with Turnbull's diplomacy on this issue, as with his predecessors, is that by simply expressing concern about something without any expectation that that's actually going to change China's behaviour, we end up just looking weak. The fact is that China is not going to back off in the South China Sea unless it believes that it would face an actual armed confrontation with the United States. And it doesn't believe that. And that's because the United States itself has been so ambiguous in the messages it's sent. And the more the Chinese, for example, look at what's happening in America today, look at the kinds of things that are happening in the US presidential election, the less worried they are that America is going to be the kind of country which is prepared to risk a conflict with a country as powerful and as important economically with China as China in order to defend what are inherently worthless rocks and reefs in the South China Sea. So I think there's a real risk for Australia, as there is for America, in using the South China Sea dispute as the point at which we draw the line around China. We do have to draw some lines somewhere, but we better draw the lines at points where we're really prepared to take a stand, and I don't think we are in the South China Sea.
Now, you mentioned the whole issue of Chinese investment in Australia, and this has obviously caused concern in some circles as this investment grows. How important do you think this is politically as an issue here, and how do you see China's general intentions? Is this about reinforcing its food security or just making a buck or what?
Look, I think it's a very important set of questions for us, and it really in some ways goes to the heart of the whole issue about how Australia feels about and how we accommodate ourselves to living with a China which is going to become, in all probability, the most powerful country in the world. It's already got the world's biggest economy on one measure. It will almost certainly have the world's biggest economy on any measure within a decade. And by the middle of the century, it could easily be the world's largest economy by a big margin. And that's going to be a very different world for Australia than the world we've been living in really since European settlement. When we look at China's investment in Australia and for that matter elsewhere, I think there are at least two things going on. The first is their Chinese companies are just looking for profits like every other company does. But more deeply, there is a kind of a Chinese agenda here, which is particularly through initiatives like the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and the One Belt, One Road idea, whereby China wants to position itself at the centre of, a dense network of global logistic infrastructure networks, because it wants to make sure that in the globalised manufacturing chains of the 21st century, China's at the centre of them. And so they're going to be willing to spend a lot of money on infrastructure. They're going to tie investment infrastructure to broader economic opportunities in China of the sort that Malcolm Turnbull is very keen on. And if Australia wants to be part of that model of Asia's and, for that matter, the world's economic future, we're going to have to accept a pretty high level of Chinese investment in their infrastructure. If we chose as a country, we can, as a sovereign country, choose to be left out of that, but we might, in the process, be choosing to marginalise ourselves in the most important economic dynamic of the century. So the economic costs to us could be very high. Moreover, if we start to exclude Chinese investment on a basis which is manifestly different and, so to speak, more political than the basis we use for evaluating investments from other countries, we should expect that to have a significant political effect on the relationship, as we would expect if the same thing happened the other way around. So I think this is a very difficult issue for Australia, but in the end, I think we're going to have to learn to live with the fact that China, as a very powerful country, as a very wealthy country, is going to be doing a lot to shape the global and regional economic environment, and we're not going to be able to do without its investment.
Do you think there's any difference between the Chinese leasing the port of Darwin on the one hand and trying to buy the Kidman land empire on the other?
Look, there are some investments which have a national security connotation which is separate from their economic connotation. And the argument on the Darwin port lease in particular has become contentious because of the national security connotations. I think there are some investments in which one can legitimately argue that national security reasons require you or suggest that you should at least limit overseas investment in them. But I think you've got to be very careful about using that. Very often, people who are opposed to foreign investment for all sorts of reasons use national security as a kind of a catch-all. And it's a convenient catch-all because all you have to say is that's a national security problem and people tend to back off and stop questioning it. If we look at the Darwin case, for example, the concern is that the Chinese will be able to use their company's activities in Darwin to gather intelligence on what's happening in Port Darwin. Well, I don't think they need to own the port in order to know what ships are going in and out or even what stuff is going over the dock. I'd be very doubtful that a Chinese company, even one with PLA connections, as is alleged in the case of the Darwin port, that significantly enhances China's capacity to collect information about what's happening in Port Darwin. If we have things in Darwin we need to keep secret, we have to do a lot more than just make sure that an Aussie company is owning it.
Now, much has been made of the recently concluded free trade agreement with China, but China's recently announced new e-commerce laws. What effect are they going to have?
There's a whole range of things that are happening in China at the moment which threaten to make it a more difficult place for Australian companies to do business, and the e-commerce laws are very much part of that. Interestingly, they themselves have a national security a pretext, if not reason, behind them. I think there's probably a fair bit of straight politics going on there as well. Look, this is going to make China, in some ways, a harder place to do business. I don't think there's much Australia can do about that.
Soon after, we were told it was all going to be easier with
course.
The FTA.
Well, the FTA, I think, was always oversold. I think FTAs are, in general, oversold. It's not that they are not valuable. It's not that they don't provide opportunities. But the economists tell me that if you look at the impact of FTAs on the long term, the amount of actual new economic activity they generate is very low. So I think, you know, we should not be too optimistic about the FTAs. In the end, whether Australian businesses can really make a buck out of China is going to depend a lot on whether we can provide what China's after at a price it's prepared to pay. And I think we're going to have to work very hard at that, and the environment is going to become tougher.
Tougher in what sort of way with these new laws?
Well, I think in two ways. The first is that we're clearly in a phase in which China's political system is trying to increase its measure of control over what happens in China. We're used to thinking of China as a highly authoritarian and regimented society. But in some ways, it's not actually. In some ways, it's been pretty laissez-faire. You see a country of 1.4 billion growing at 10% per annum. There's an awful lot going on there, and there's a lot that the government, certainly the central government in Beijing, simply can't control. I think we're now seeing, under Xi Jinping, a clear attempt to try and reassert a closer control over the way China works. And it is a strong and effective state. It's quite good at developing and implementing the kinds of policies which allow it to increase this control. And I think we're seeing it in steps like the e-commerce changes and some of the issues on information technology, for example. And I think this is going to make China a harder environment for overseas companies to operate in. And we're just going to have to work around that. Not much we can do about it.
Let's just turn to a couple of more general questions. You used to be a defence advisor to Kim Beazley when he was in that portfolio, so you know a lot about submarines. The new submarines, the decision on that contract is coming up soon. Who do you think will win the contract?
Well, I don't think I'm going to make a guess on who will actually
win it. Who should win it?
Who should win it? Let me make 2 points. The first is that I think we need to make the judgment on the submarines on two separate bases. The one is a technical judgment. Who's got the better boat and who can build it best working with Australians? And the second is, so to speak, a political and strategic judgment. And the reason that's so important is that two of the bidders, the French and the Germans, are just in it for the money. There's no politics and there's no strategy in that, because in their bids. It's simply a matter of saying who has the best boat for the best price and who can build it best in Australia. The Japanese bid is different. The Japanese are very clear. They've been absolutely explicit. For them, they are not bidding to build Australia's submarines because they want to make money out of it. They're doing it because they want to build a closer strategic relationship with Australia. And so if Australia accepts that bid, we're going to have to pay the Japanese not just the monetary price they're asking, but also to offer them, to deliver to them, the strategic relationship thereafter.
And they, of course, are thinking of the Chinese.
And they are thinking absolutely of the Chinese. For Japan, they see the submarine deal with Australia as a way of consolidating what is, in effect, an alliance between Australia and Japan directed at China. And Australia has to ask very carefully whether that's going to be in our interests. Now, it's not that we don't have a strong interest in Japan remaining secure. It's not that we don't have strong connections with Japan. It's been a marvellous relationship. But whether Australia, remember, with the submarine deal, we're talking about looking 50 years ahead, that the first of the new boats won't even be delivered for 25 or 30 years. So whether Australia wants to make a decision in 2016 that we're prepared to align our interests in our relationship with China with Japan's interests in its relationship with China is, to me, extremely doubtful. And so I would very strongly argue against accepting the Japanese bid, even if the Japanese boats were the best in the business, simply because I think the strategic price is likely to be too high to pay. As a separate point, as a matter of fact, although the Soyuz, the Japanese boat, has some strong merits, I do think it's likely that the Japanese and that the Germans and the French bids will be technically superior and will also be coming from companies with more experience of building submarines in partnership with customer companies. The Germans have done this a lot, the French have done it a bit, the Japanese have never done it at all. And it's a very complicated relationship. Sitting down with a foreign country and saying, let's build a submarine together, is not like deciding to go on a picnic together. It's a very complicated and messy business.
Obviously, the submarine contract's a central issue currently for defence policy. In broad terms, though, how do you see Australia's defence policy placed at the moment? Have we the most effective policy that we can have, should have, or not?
Look, I don't think we have, and I think there's a very deep and important reason for that. Australia's defence policy today, the way we conceive of our defence policy, really goes back to that moment at the end of the Vietnam War, where the US and China kind of did a deal with one another, the Chinese stepped back and accepted American primacy, and Asia became very peaceful. And we built a defence policy that really goes all the way back to the mid-1970s and through things like the Dibb Review and Kim Beazley's white paper around that kind of concept. And right at the heart of that was the idea that in an Asia in which US primacy was not contested, Australia didn't have to think about fighting a great power in Asia. Now, when we look forward from 2016, we cannot afford to assume that the United States is going to play that same kind of role. The US primacy is no longer uncontested. Already that era has passed. But it's quite possible, within the timeframes that are relevant to our defence planning, decades ahead, that the US will cease to play anything like the role it plays in Asia at the moment. And when we look at the kinds of things that people like, not just Donald Trump, but Bernie Sanders, and for that matter, Ted Cruz, everyone except Hillary Clinton, in fact, is saying in the US presidential campaign, even President Obama himself, for us to take for granted that America continues to dominate Asia the way it has in the past is simply, I think, a very weak basis for defence policy. But that idea remains right at the heart of our defence policy. The government's new white paper, delivered just in February, had the idea of the US remaining the dominant power in Asia right at the heart of the posture. I think we need to start rethinking Australia's defence around the very credible possibility that in the timeframes that are relevant to our current defence choices, we will find ourselves in an Asia in which the United States is no longer the dominant power, and that increases the requirements for Australian defence.
But how flexible can we be? Are you talking just about increasing spending or different equipment or what?
Very, very important question. I think we need to redefine our strategic objectives. That is what we want our defence forces to be able to do. I think we have to focus our objectives more narrowly, and we have to spend more on them. So I would have a defence force which was focused very specifically on improving our capacity to prevent other countries projecting power by sea. We have the advantage of living on an island. All our neighbours are islands. We can defend ourselves and help defend our neighbours by preventing others projecting power
by
sea.
How do you do that?
You spend lots of money on submarines. So I'd have a submarine fleet that was twice as big as the one that we're talking about, or even three times as big. You spend a lot of money on frontline combat aircraft.
That would terrify even Scott Morrison.
It possibly would. But it would also terrify the admirals, because I'd spend much less on nice big surface ships. I'd spend much less money on trying to project the Australian Army overseas. I'd spend a bit more on what the Australian Army could do at home. But it would be a very different kind of force structure, and it would cost more. And we have a choice as a country to make. If we want to remain a kind of military middle power in an Asian century in which we can no longer assume that Americans are going to be the dominant player, then we are going to have to spend more, a higher proportion of our GDP on defence than we have.
What?
I think it's going to be something like 3.5% or 4% of GDP.
And at the moment we're struggling to get to 2%.
To 2%. So this is a high number. And by comparison, the last time we spent that kind of money was during the Cold War. In the 1950s and 1960s, our defence spending over those two decades, when we were involved in forward defence and conflicts like Korea and Vietnam, averaged about 3.5% of GDP.
Could any government sell this domestically?
Well, only if they could explain to Australians that if they want to remain a middle power, they'll have to spend this kind of money. If they don't want to, if we don't want to spend that kind of money, that's fine, as long as we're happy to have a defence posture like New Zealand's. That's the option. Now, the New Zealand's defence posture works for New Zealand
because it's got protection from Australia.
But there's nobody between us and Asia that does for us what we do for the Kiwis. And so we just have to decide whether we're prepared to take that risk or not. It's a perfectly straightforward public policy choice. And I think it would be perfectly legitimate for Australia to decide not to spend that money, but it would be very illegitimate of the government, successive governments, to tell Australians that we're still getting the same security we used to get at 2% of GDP, when Asia is becoming much more contested strategically, and 2% of Australia's GDP buys less and less because our GDP relative to those of our countries in our region is going down pretty sharply. The United States is not the only one experiencing relative economic decline. So are we. When I first started in this business, Australia's economy was bigger than China's. And it was bigger than the whole of ASEAN's put together. That now seems impossibly remote. But when we talked about spending 2% of GDP as a basis for Australian defence spending, that was a 2% of GDP, which was the second biggest GDP in Asia. Those days are long gone.
And it does show how things change very quickly.
Very quickly. That's right.
Hugh White, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from the Conversations podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.